And our connection this hour was made this past Friday, when much of New York State moved into that phase, phase one of economic reopening. If things go well enough, we could see barbershops and salons back open in June, restaurants in early summer. And yet, somehow, even a pandemic has become enmeshed in the culture war. Want to move cautiously? Why, you must hate small businesses. Want to open everything yesterday? Well, you must want millions to die. The reality, of course, is a lot more nuanced, but some of the confusion, some of the public concern might come down to simple communication issues. New York Times opinion writer Charlie Warzel writes, quote, "Heading into our pandemic summer, my biggest worry is that in the effort to get Americans to flatten the coronavirus curve, nobody prepared the country for what comes next. The resentment I'm worried about is distrust in authorities. Months into the pandemic, some people feel as if the goalposts have been moved. You said to flatten the curve. We made sacrifices. Now you're saying it's not enough?" End quote. So how do we move into these next phases and make sure we all have the same ideas about what the standards are, how to do it, how do we communicate effectively so we don't have confusion about what's safe, what's not, who should open, who should not, who should wear a mask, who shouldn't. Charlie Warzel is one of my favorite writers on the national scene, and he is with us now. Thank you for making the time, Charlie. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with them. Why don't you kind of recap for listeners, because I want to play a few clips here, but I want you to recap for listeners really what you were aiming to communicate with the piece that I just referenced there, the biggest concerns you have as all these different states are moving into different phases.
Yeah. So, I've noticed for the past couple of weeks as the reopening conversation has been happening nationally that there's a small section of people out there who are obviously involved in sort of the liberate protests, and those are protesting the stay-at-home orders, and a lot of people open carrying semi-automatic weapons in public, and protesting masks as a sort of a tyrannical government request, and that's not exactly who I'm concerned about, but I'm concerned about a different segment of the population who seem to be really frustrated with the idea that that there's still progress that has to be made on the virus suppression front. And these are people who I think have largely complied with the stay-at-home orders, who have done their part, who have made great personal sacrifices to flatten the curve. These are people who really bought into the idea of flattening the curve, but they believed that flattening the curve was all that we had to do. Stay at home for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, we'll get those cases down, and then we can sort of, come out of this and really regain a big sense of normalcy. And I'm worried about that contingent of people because I think that their hearts are in the right place. I think that they have done a responsible thing. They want to do the right thing. But I think that there was a real communications issue because we don't really have a federal government that has been communicating this. It's been left up to, state and local officials. And so I think that, part of the problem is that if you listen to in the early days of the pandemic to the people talking about flattening the curve, it was one component of a broader solution. You flatten the curve, which means actually delaying the peak of the virus and keeping hospitalizations down and making sure our medical system doesn't become too stressed. And then the next part is the suppression part, which is where we, employ mass testing, mass contact tracing. We, potentially isolate cases from positive cases from family members. And we actually work to drive the virus down to zero in terms of cases. So I think that wasn't properly communicated, those two distinctions. And what I worry is that we have this group of people that did make a real sacrifice and now feels, as I wrote in the piece, that the goalposts have been moved a little bit.
So I want to listen to a little bit of sound that I think illustrates that. And then I kind of want to get your take on how we evaluate maybe who's to blame for this sentiment. This is Dave Portnoy. He's the founder of Barstool Sports, which is a massively popular outlet. I realize on public radio, our listeners may not overlap perfectly, but I will tell listeners, if you don't know Dave Portnoy, I mean, he is the head of what has become for the, younger, or I should say younger millennial and Gen Z set, a very, very popular sort of sports media empire, really kind of a culture media empire, mostly for guys. He's got hundreds of thousands of fans and followers every day. And this video that I'm about to play a clip from has been watched more than 8 million times. Let's listen.
When did this become flatten the curve, flatten the curve, flatten the curve to we have to find a cure or everyone's going to die? Like Fauci. Seems like a nice enough dude. I've always been like, oh, no agenda. Looks like he could be maybe the grandfather in Wedding Crashers. Gets in front of the Senate. He's like, we reopen the country too quick. Everyone's dead. Where'd that come from? And the L.A. mayor. We're not opening the city till we find a cure. What? Find a cure? Who says we're going to find a cure? We haven't found a cure to cancer. Took AIDS 20 years or whatever. Do we even have a cure?
Now, to be clear, Charlie, he's criticizing things there that weren't actually really said. He's essentially inventing fake Fauci quotes. Fauci did not tell the Senate that if we reopen that everyone's dead. But Portnoy has the passion that he seems to believe that that's what was said, or at least was implied, and certainly his followers believe it. And this is what's gained some velocity. So who do you blame for this? Is he at fault for not actually listening? Is Anthony Fauci at fault for what he said to the Senate, getting people confused? I mean, who do you blame for this?
Yeah, this is sort of like a Russian nesting doll of bad faith here, right? the sentiment is one that I sympathize with, broadly speaking. And I'm talking about people who aren't trying to sort of weaponize this. I'm talking about, you know, people who really feel like they've sacrificed a lot to keep others around them healthy and maybe, you know, are fatigued by that, which is totally understandable. And people who also feel like they have to start clawing back little pieces of normalcy wherever they can, that, you know, that stringent lockdowns, you know, have to be lifted a little bit, or you know, you have to be able to have some outlets for, you know, to live parts of your life. That, I believe, is very understandable. This guy he's sort of built a media empire, as you said, on participating in parts of this broader culture war. I think he's a very savvy, I think he knows exactly what he's doing here. And I think he knows that he's sort of leveraging that understandable feeling in order, you know, to kind of stoke some populist resentment. I mean, I think that's in bad faith. I think if he was paying attention mm-hmm. to what experts like Dr. Fauci were saying, he would understand that you know, this is a multi-step approach. Flatten the curve was one part of it. Now, the problem is most people don't pay strict attention
right.
to this. And that's why you need a very clear and broad set of messaging strategies. And this is really where I think like the failure of the Trump administration comes in. And you know, when you look at those series of press conferences that went on for about a month or so before they eventually pulled the plug, what happened was you had experts come on, give a sort of sober diagnosis of the current state of the virus, cases, mitigation and suppression tactics, testing practices, all this. And then you had the president come in and completely, you know, muddle through for about an hour of questioning. Mm-hmm. Obviously that made the headlines, but the messaging around this virus has just been completely unclear from the federal level, you know, from the beginning, from not taking it seriously, talking about, you know, the cases will go down to zero very quickly, to then taking it seriously for a couple of weeks and then pivoting back on that to sort of focus on a, we have to reopen America, let's be open by Easter, pack the churches, et cetera. So what a normal person can be who doesn't keep up with this stuff as much as, you know, you or I or some, you know, avid news consumer could be forgiven for not really understanding the multi-tiered approach. I mean, the federal government doesn't really have a very, broad sweeping suppression plan, which includes mass testing and tracing on a federal level, not just by state by state. That's been left up to a lot of governors. So, you know, that's a long-winded way of me saying, I think that someone like Portnoy is taking advantage of this lack of communication on the federal government and sort of just leveraging it for a culture war fight.
So I just want to hit one other point that Portnoy makes there, because again, I've got Tim writes to me to say, Evan, the problem is too many influential people in this country actually don't think we ever should reopen. That's from Tim. I don't know who you're talking about, Tim, and I'm not trying to be sort of kind of trollish or condescending. I really don't know. One of our listeners told me, well, Zeke Emanuel said that. That's Rahm Emanuel's brother. I don't think Zeke is setting policy, and I can't actually find a quote. And Portnoy referenced not just Fauci, but Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Well, here's the actual quote from what Eric Garcetti said. It was in an interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos on Good Morning America. Garcetti said, quote, I think we have to all recognize that we're not moving beyond COVID-19. We're learning to live with it. We've never been fully closed and will never be completely open until we have a cure. End quote. Is that bad communication? I mean, and look, there was a longer interview. I'm sure he said more than that. But I think that's what Portnoy is talking about. Charlie, do they have to be careful, every elected leader in the country, to make sure that the message can't be confused? Or do we have to sort of point the finger at the grifters who are taking advantage of that?
I think it's manifold, right? There's you have to do both things. You have to really, you know, point out these people, as you said, like grifters or who are latching onto this in order to score, you know, either partisan points or just to sort of, you know, stoke up outrage because it's a way to, you know, gain some engagement and some currency online. But I do think leaders have to be better about this. I mean, I think if you're an elected official, I mean, you should make sure that, you know, that your quotes can't be taken out of context easily, mm-hmm. which means, you know, surrounding those things with statements, which are true, we want to get back to normal as soon as possible. In an ideal situation, we would like to be open. We understand how much people are hurting. I mean, I think most elected officials are doing this to some degree, but I think that there is a desire I think a lot of people are afraid to express, both sides of this, which is to say, we do have to stay locked down in certain places for longer. There's a desire to want to gloss over the hard truths. But I think also we have to really sympathize and empathize with those who want who want the freedom to get back to normalcy, because that's a very understandable sentiment. I mean, we all want that to some degree. I thought it was interesting what you said about the reader you don't know, or the person who wrote in to you, that you don't know a single person who holds that view. And I think that's true. There's so many people who are talking, sort of blaming the media and saying they want these lockdowns to last forever. Mm-hmm. Well, the news media is being savaged right now.
Absolutely.
On the financial, from a financial perspective, due to these lockdowns, the advertising markets are cratering. I mean, this is, if you're talking about an existential crisis for local journalism and even some national journalism, I mean, this is it. So I would be hard pressed to find a single journalist who would like these conditions to continue, because I think everyone's job is basically at risk here. So I think that's the consideration. But then again, that's just this being, you know, sort of weaponized for a larger culture war.
Well, and there's a couple of points there, and then we'll work in a little bit more listener feedback. I see on the phone, and if you want to call the program, we're talking to Charlie Warzel, New York Times opinion writer at large, who's written some of the really smart, thoughtful stuff during the last 2 months about this pandemic. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And I want listeners to maybe answer what I'm going to ask Charlie now. Are you happy that it's mostly Governor Cuomo doing the talking? Are you happy when it is an elected leader, a politician, who is at the mic for 90% of the time? In your piece, you referenced another one of my favorite writers, Charles Duhigg's piece in The New Yorker, which contrasts King County, Washington, Seattle, and New York City / New York State, and the very different spikes, how bad the outbreaks got and what happened. And as Duhigg writes in The New Yorker, in the Pacific Northwest, for the most part, they elevated the public health leaders and they turned over most of the Q&A with reporters to them. The public became very familiar with them. And, you know, politicians were there to certainly answer. They're going to answer for policy. They're responsible for that. But most of it, especially in those early days of the outbreak, that's who was at the mic. Here in New York State, you just heard Governor Cuomo. He does daily briefings, and he communicates very clearly. There's no question about that. He does say he's accountable for the policy. He likes to say, blame me if you don't like it. I think that's appreciated. But most of the questions he will take on. Now, if there's a moment where he doesn't fully understand, on the medical side, he's got Dr. Howard Zucker. I don't think Dr. Zucker's a household name in New York State because he doesn't answer many questions. You heard Melissa DeRosa, who's been his chief of staff, among other roles, who's headed up a lot of the response from the government side. She will jump in at times, but it's 80 to 90% Governor Cuomo. That's a contrast, as Duhigg writes, to what happened in the Pacific Northwest. And I wonder what model you prefer, Charlie Wurzel.
I think ideally you would want a tandem, right? You'd want a pairing of the medical professionals with the politicians, but you'd want them to be on the same page. What made those White House press conferences so horrible for our collective understanding of this crisis and the messaging around it is you basically had the public health officials say something, and then they were rebutted mm-hmm. by the president of the United States, and then the public health officials had to kind of sneak back onto the podium and hedge around that and basically try to not offend the president while trying to correct medical misinformation. That's the absolute nightmare scenario, where you've just muddled the message so much that there's no real understanding and people walk away feeling actually either worse or have less of a handle on the crisis than when they started. I think that to some degree what these public health officials do is they're very good at expressing their uncertainty. They're very good at being cautious and only giving the facts that they absolutely know to be true. And that's not necessarily all that reassuring. Politicians are very good at being reassuring, are very good at, you know, handling a narrative properly. But oftentimes what that does is that gives people a false sense of confidence mm-hmm. or it doesn't really communicate the risk adequately. So I actually think that like the best thing to do is to hedge both of those. Right. In my column, which you quoted earlier, I cited this paper from an organization called SIDRAP, which is an infectious disease organization, I think associated with the University of Minnesota. I hope I'm right on that. But it has six different recommendations for how to communicate clearly during a pandemic. Things like don't over reassure, proclaim uncertainty, give people things to do, admit and apologize for errors. And these six points, are really great. And what they basically say is that you have to level with people. At the end of the day, what you have to do is communicate the hard and difficult truths. And even if those things are incredibly depressing or, you know, very disturbing, people will ultimately respect being leveled with. People don't want things to be sugarcoated.
Let me grab Bonnie in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, well, just maybe to pick up on what we're talking about now, you know, this is a very, 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 very difficult situation. Has a lot of feelings about it, which you're not going to just wave a wand and go away. And, you know, so it causes a lot of pain. So when people are in that kind of situation, they want to give me something I can get away from it. Give me a good bath, give me a good something so I can. And so I think it's, you know, I agree totally that the straightness, if you're going to be straight with people, but that straightness also carries a certain kind of, you know, yes and no. Oh, I want you to be straight, but oh God, I want to be over with at the same time. So that's normal. And I think to some extent we have to accept some of that. The problem is you get Trump in them, who knows nothing about anything, and you get them to weaponize these things. And it starts to get, when you get nearer the election, really, really, really not just nasty, but starts to border on, you know, his usual, what I call psychopathic behavior. And by the way, I'm really glad to see there's been some writings, all of a sudden a few more articles about his psychotic behavior, which I think has been in denial in a lot of the media, too. But at any rate, all those things come together, and I think people sometimes look, give me the one that I can now look forward to, and give me that thing that's going to help me feel better, which is, as I say, kind of a normal thing, but I think it's a struggle. And, science people who know more about this will say, you know, here, I have to tell you the truth. It's like going to the doctor, and I have some bad news for you. We're going to talk about it. You don't always want to accept that, but you have to live with it. And I think some of these people who are like, there's some place I saw near me the other day that they're having a party in their backyard and kissing each other and hugging each other and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you wonder what is in their mind. And they were younger to middle age. So I'm wondering, what are you thinking, that it's okay now, that, you know, excuse my language with you, I don't care anymore. What is it with some of those people?
All right, so let me just jump in here, Bunny. Let me just jump in here for a second here. I appreciate the call. I'll let Charlie respond. I will say this, especially as we finally move in, this is going to be the best weather week we've seen since last year, and everyone's ready here. I don't know what the weather's like in Montana. It's been awful here this spring. And so let me just kind of address Bonnie's point there. You are going to see people at backyards around fires, and they may be family, and they may be hugging and kissing each other. You don't know if they got tested the day before and then locked down until they got results 24 hours later and then loosened their guard a little. You don't know if they live together. I'm just very careful about shaming that. And I understand we all have to do our part, and I'm with you. We've been part of that from the beginning here. But I also want to give a little empathy for people to be a little human, not to say it's okay. You know, you heard Julia Marcus on this program last week, and I really endorse what she's been writing about. But we've got to be human here. And I'm just trying to find a strike of balance, because I think, Charlie, if we overshame, that starts to play into this narrative that, well, you don't even want us to live our lives anymore.
Right. I think that's true. I mean, what everyone in the last 5 minutes has been saying is I think is true. You have to find some empathy, and I think too we you know, this is part of the messaging. Part of the messaging coming from, and this is why having a federal government response is so important, that is clear, is setting out some of these rules, is saying, you know, okay, so the guidance is changing on what we know about outdoor transmission, right? So here are five ways you can be outdoors this summer, and that, you know, you can carve out a semblance of normalcy, and that we shouldn't shame that. And I think that that's important. But the problem is, because things are so muddled right now, because, you know, we have back in April, you know, there was a study that was immediately sort of debunked about, you know, running and how that was spreading germs all over the place from, I believe, some Dutch scientists. You know, you have these all this information that is clouding people's understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And then no central authority, you know, giving guidance. And that is how we end up with all of this shaming, with, you know, people looking at telephoto lens shots of a beach that actually isn't crowded but looks crowded, and, you know, and people are getting into fights on the internet about that. I really think that, you know, part of the job of the federal government right now is to not just say we need to have, you know, we need to find ways to reopen, but to give people actionable guidance. You know, one of the points on those, that six steps that I wrote about last week, was give people things to do, right? And one of the recommendations on that was, what if, you know, state and local authorities come up with a points system for different socially distanced behaviors, and those points are associated with risk, and you're allowed to get, say, 40 risk points over the course of a week. So going to the grocery store, 10 points, you know, going outside to the park and socially distancing in a hangout with some friends, you know, 14 points. And you get to basically have some agency in cobbling together a life. Now, are you taking on risk? Absolutely. You know, could something bad happen as a result? Yes. But you're also given sort of a framework and a structure in which you can try to live your life around, that gives you a little bit of calm, a little bit of certainty that you might not have had before. I think those things are crucial for us to get through the next couple months.
Listeners, if you want to check out Charlie's piece, and you really ought to be following all of his writing, we'll post it on our various platforms. Linda in Penfield is next on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thanks for the topic. So you were mentioning that in Washington, it was the public health director for the state, you know, conveying the message. And I think in a usual time, I would be okay with that. But considering that New York and New York City were the epicenter of all this, I'm glad that it's Governor Cuomo, and he knows when to turn the mic over when he needs to. And he's just been a balance of straight and also compassionate. And as far as local leaders, I think that Monroe County has done a marvelous job with Adam Bello and Dr. Michael Mendoza, who I think is a rock star, coming out and giving information. And I'm glad that we have Adam Bello and Dr. Mendoza and Governor Cuomo in this state. And I think that's what's been keeping us safe. So that's my comment.
All right. Well, thank you, Lynn. And look, I hear from people every day. They call it lunch with the governor. I mean, they aim for 11:30 whenever the governor starts, and they're used to hearing him. And they know they can count on the fact that he's going to deliver a public message every day. I do think that that's important. I think it's important to have elected leaders say, we're going to set this policy and I will be responsible. Put the blame on me if it doesn't go well. I think that's important. And he has done that. But Charlie Wardzell, I also think about a conversation I had with a scientist years ago, maybe the last 5 years ago. And he said, when it comes to climate change, so much started with an inconvenient truth and Al Gore. And even if the message was right, it basically geared half the people who heard that message to say, you know, no way. It can't be right because it was a political actor and we have this frame. Now, sometimes in a crisis, we bring those partisan, you know, that sort of patina of partisanship down a little bit. But is it inevitable that eventually we will move back towards not taking the message seriously if it comes from people in politics too much?
It certainly charges every argument this way. I mean, I think I was watching a debate about 2 weeks ago online of whether or not, you know, the president should have brought other presidents in to have sort of a unified message, as, you know, some presidents have called on their predecessors during crises to sort of, you know, invoke that sense of unity. And there are a lot of people who, you know, who obviously, you know, are disdainful of George W. Bush or Obama or whoever, and you know, everyone has their own opinions on that. But I mean, I do think a bipartisan message for a lot of people is helpful. It certainly sort of shows a little bit of solidarity, and any solidarity is better than none. But you know, this is the problem with especially current elected leaders being the public health mouthpieces, which is that, you know, ultimately they have jobs to do, which is to stay in office and serve the people and you know, boost their approval rating. And so there is going to be an air of partisanship to that. It's really difficult. It kind of muddies everything. But you know, you would hope that in a crisis like this, we would find ways to sort of strip the politics out. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
All right, so here's a little dissent to your piece, Charlie. Dan says he can tell that you're writing this from inside a bubble, and says that I'm not sure that people focused on what's happening inside New York City make the best sources of information when it comes to what's happening outside of New York City. Where do you live, Charlie?
I live in Missoula, Montana, which is sort of unexpected for a New York Times writer. But, you know, I understand that there's, everyone is living through this pandemic with different circumstances. Some people are frontline workers, some people are essential workers, some people don't have any choice but to go out and work. Some people can work from home behind their computer screens. Some people have jobs that you know, become more important during a pandemic. Some people have jobs you know, where they're immediately laid off the second that people, you know, can't go out and participate in the economy. Everyone's experiencing this differently. You know, I will say in Montana, where I live, the governor acted very quickly, shut down the schools and put a stay-at-home order before there were even hardly any cases or deaths. As a result, we have really tamped down our cases here. We've had zero cases multiple days over the past couple of weeks, and we are in a phased reopening, and that makes sense. That actually makes sense for Montana. People, you know, if there are no cases, people should be able to resume certain activities. That said, you know, there are restaurants, there are bars, there are places that people love, and they're not necessarily being patronized right now because people are scared. You know, you can say we want to reopen the economy, but you have to have people willing to participate in order for that economy to actually reopen. So, I mean, what I would say to that person is A, yes, I'm part of a bubble in some ways. In other ways, I'm out there living the exact same experiences as many people in America. But I think uncertainty is the prevailing feeling right now. Anxiety is the prevailing feeling right now among most people, even people like myself who would love to be back out there, and even people like myself who believe that, you know, a state like Montana, which has gotten this under control, should have phased reopenings and should see, you know, different parts of the economy restored.
Dan does say, by the way, that, you know, this idea of a point system, he says it wouldn't be compulsory, but would give people a feeling of control, like distract people, surveil them, convince them that surveillance is a securing and liberating collaboration, not a dystopian authoritarian overreach. I'm not saying Wurzel is the party, but the philosophy behind this kind of piece, I'm afraid, boils down to Big Brother is your friend. You want to hit that one as well, Charlie?
Well, I would direct him to look at a project I helped spearhead for the Times, which is the Privacy Project, which was a year-long reporting exercise against different parts of surveillance, both government-wise and also corporate. So I'm definitely not on the side of American citizens being surveilled. I don't think that you have to look at these rules and regulations as necessarily, you know, Big Brother or as tyranny. For example, you know, a lot of people are saying, I'm never going to wear a mask. No one can make me wear a mask. You know, this is the government imposing their will. Well, you know, you stop at stop signs or you stop at red lights, and those are government signs and regulations that, you know, impede your behavior. You take off your shoes at the airport, and you didn't do that before, you know, September 11th, 2001. There are things that we do to adapt, and the government puts those procedures in place based off of, you know, different risk assessments that they make. Sometimes you agree with them, sometimes you don't. But we need guidance to get through this. This is bigger than all of us. This is something the entire world is going through. This isn't something that we're going through alone. This isn't something that we're experiencing in an outsized way. We're quite literally all in this together, and we're all dependent on each other, which is what really makes this virus so much different than other aspects of policy. Our actions all affect everyone else in a real outsized way, and can cause one person can cause great harm if they choose to disobey, you know, the standard guidance. So what I would say there is that, you know, this isn't necessarily a Big Brother situation. This is a situation of how do we all work towards a common goal where we're all healthier and safer, and more responsible. And I think a government authority is probably the only group that can fill that need of guidance.
Charlie Wurzel is a New York Times opinion writer at large, joining us from his home in Montana. And I want to thank you for taking the time. You're generous with it. And I hope that you have plenty of people reading and listening and joining the conversation. I think it's important. I think clear communication is important. And I'm glad you brought that to our attention and your readers and our listeners. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
The great Charlie Wurzel. Let's take our only break here in between here. And then coming up next hour, we're talking to the team from PBS Nova. They've got their sights set on what it would take to get a vaccine done faster than ever before. That's next.